This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, November 8th, 2005. Valerie Plame, CIA operative, teases her husband that all his life he's had a Forrest Gump effect. That he's always been there when things happen, though outsiders would never know it. It's a characterization, she says, that she's proud of. This allusion to Forrest Gump was published in Vanity Fair's profile of Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame, January 17, 2004, double exposure. Forrest Gump, the innocent who happens to be in all the important and historic making places. Forrest Gump, the innocent. Forrest Gump, Joseph Wilson, former ambassador. And Valerie Plame, CIA operative. This we will go into more. Is he a Forrest Gump, or is he himself a CIA operative? The hidden agenda of the Libby indictment, the night of the long knives, our second part in this series. Ralph?
The night of the long knives is the famous event in which the SS ambushed the SA, the Brown Shirts. The Brown Shirts were a parallel organization to the SS, vying for Hitler's favor, but more than that, the SA had a conduit into Hitler's entourage, and they had an agenda that was not the same as that of the SS. The SS, under Hitler's direction, ambushed the SA and massacred them to a person in the Night of the Long Knives, an appropriate analogy and historical precedent for the real underlying hidden agenda of the Fitzgerald indictments and the Central Intelligence Agency's conflict with their rivals amongst the neocons.
Ralph, Valerie Plame was revealed as a CIA operative by Robert Novak in his syndicated column July 14, 2003. Novak, a conservative columnist, had tried to discredit Joseph Wilson, former ambassador to Niger and Gabon and Principe and Sao Tome, and also a member, former member of the National Security Council, and at one time an assistant to Al Gore when he was a senator. And then on July 22nd in Newsday, the reporters Newt Royce and Timothy Phelps revealed that Valerie Plame was not just a CIA agent, but she was an undercover officer. This set off investigations, and particularly that of the assignment of Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, into whether the intelligence laws of the United States, specifically the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982, had been violated. In the process, I. Lewis Libby, the chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney and a well-known neocon, in fact, one of the authors of Rebuilding America's Defenses and a founder of Project for a New American Century, along with Dick Cheney, that I. Lewis Libby was indicted by Patrick Fitzgerald for perjury and obstruction of justice, in other words, impeding the investigation. In part one, we went into some of the elements of the hidden agenda of the Libby indictment, and we referred to some of the history of Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson. Let's go a little deeper into Joseph Wilson's history as an operative for the United States.
Maya, it's interesting to examine how they, the circumstances in which they met. And this article, it's a 38-page article in the Vanity Fair, is a smoking gun. Wilson was based in Stuttgart. He was the chief political advisor to George Juwan, the United States general in charge of European command. This is a high-level responsibility. Valerie Plame at the time was based in Brussels, and in her capacity there as a high-level secret operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, she had responsibilities in Paris, London, and Brussels, also related to the European Command. Their encounter is instructive. The description by Vanity Fair is as follows with respect to Valerie Plame. She was known to her classmates at the farm in Camp Peary, Virginia, the CIA's training facility, where former CIA agent Jim Marcinkowski observed her, that she had, quote, considerable prowess wielding the AK-47 machine gun. She was chosen for the Central Intelligence Agency responsibility because she came from a military family with it which had imbued her. Quote, I was in the NSA, the National Security Agency, for 3 years, states her father, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Plame. Her close friend Janet Angstadt confirms that the relationship between the father's role in the NSA and the preparing of Valerie Plame as a covert operative skilled in the use of an AK-47 and involved in the kinds of covert operations that entailed the murder and assassination and elimination of dissidents is more than a casual connection. Indeed, the responsibility for Plame in this capacity reached far beyond local arenas. She learned Greek and spoke French and German and was assigned to various areas in which there was disaffection from the established order, and she targeted those who were involved in that activity.
Ralph, let's make clear again that the undercover agent, as Valerie Plame was, one who didn't operate under the mantle of the State Department. She did operate under a State Department mantle at first, but later she was an NOC. That means that her cover was under a company, and she was responsible if she were ever caught. Her cover was Brewster Jennings. Brewster Jennings himself had been a founder of Saucony Mobile, and which is now Exxon Mobil, and long involved in the oil business. But Brewster Jennings is dead, and this Brewster Jennings Associates is a non-existent company. It was under this cover that Valerie Plame worked within the Middle East, recruiting agents and also handling these agents. For Joseph Wilson, as I mentioned before, he had worked for Al Gore when Al Gore was a senator, but then his postings included in the State Department Niger, Togo, Principe, Sao Tome, South Africa, and Burundi, and Gabon. And Ralph, you're very familiar with the events of these African countries at the time when Wilson was in these areas, and it goes to why Valerie Plame might say he's a Forrest Gump. In fact, he was an active participant in the events of what took place in Gabon, Niger, and elsewhere.
Maya, what we're looking at here is the Central Intelligence Agency's murder role in displacing French imperialism in Francophone Africa and insinuating United States control, and that was accomplished through a variety of CIA-sponsored activities, assassinations, coup d'etat, and indeed internecine conflict between populations within these countries that had murderous content. The massacres and the genocides of Rwanda and Burundi, the tragedies of Angola and Mozambique, with the Central Intelligence Agency-sponsored internecine civil wars that demolished these countries and created the conditions for Central Intelligence Agency control, they occur with Joseph Wilson in ample present. Joe Wilson came back to Washington as senior director for African Affairs. And I should back up a moment by saying that to give an indication of the role of Valerie Plame, she returned to Washington in 1997 because, as was reported in the New York Times at the time, Valerie Plame's name was on a list given to the Russians by the double agent Aldrich Ames. Intelligence, and that was in 1994. She was already a very high-level Central Intelligence Agency covert operative involved in key arenas sufficient for her to be outed by Aldrich Ames to the Soviet Union in 1994. When Wilson comes back to Washington at the same time, the same year, he is Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council. The National Security Council, where he is working with Reagan administration Assistant Secretary of State Chester Crocker, and indeed would become the most, quote, effective person in that job during the Clinton administration. 1 year into the job, Joseph Wilson sets up International Ventures, an office in downtown Washington, and an investment firm of which the Vanity Fair article states little is known. Indeed, he has the same kind of cover as his wife, Valerie Plame, in relation to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Ralph, let's backtrack to his career and see why he would be considered an Africa expert. After he worked for Al Gore and also for Tom Foley, the House Majority Whip, Wilson returned as Deputy Chief of Mission to the Congo Republic. And again, he was working with Chester Crocker, who at that time was the Assistant Secretary of State, and with whom you mentioned he worked later in the National Security Council. And it was while he was in the Congo that he worked on the process, what it says in the Vanity Fair article is, quote, process that led to negotiations for the withdrawal of the Cuban and South African troops from the Angolan Civil War, end quote. Now, this might sound innocuous, or rather it might sound that it's progressive. Ralph, I want you to go into the real truth. The veracity of what happened, excuse me, not veracity, but what really happened and what it meant when you had the withdrawal of the Cuban troops from the Angolan Civil War.
Well, it's called an Angolan Civil War. What you had, of course, was the struggle against Portuguese colonialism and Portuguese imperial control in the oil-rich Angola. Cabindi, the corner of Angola, has become a lake of oil opportunity for Mobil and Exxon, and indeed for the Central Intelligence Agency, which had virtually detached Cabindi as a separate arena from Angola. But the role of the National Security Council and of Chester Crocker and on the spot Wilson was to facilitate the removal of Cuban troops, which were engaged in assisting and defending the efforts of the Angolan national insurgency and to self-determination and to an independent state. There were three nationalities that were under different political direction in Angola. And the three nationalities were a virtually equal number in Angola. What Joseph Wilson was doing was, through the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council, channeling aid and setting up a conflict between these nationalities based on linguistic and national differences. Indeed, the revolutionary process in Angola was aborted by the fact that Savimbi, Jonas Savimbi, was funded and set up by the Central Intelligence Agency with Wilson in a key role here as a murder apparatus that was designed to facilitate Central Intelligence Agency destruction of the revolutionary process in Angola. You had UNITA, which was the group that was backed by the Chinese and the CIA at the same time. Then there was Savimbi, who was funded by the CIA, and 2 million lives were lost in the process. Savimbi was essentially seizing control of the diamond areas and the oil-producing areas for Central Intelligence. This is the central role of Joe Wilson in regard to Angola. It would be a similar role that would be played by him in other parts of Africa on behalf of the murder apparatus of the Central Intelligence Agency, directly parallel with the career of his wife, Valerie Plame, with her AK-47 and her covert operations from North Africa to the Middle East.
Ralph, that's true, because in 1992, Wilson was given the, rewarded, they say, with the ambassadorship to Gabon. And before we, maybe we should move ahead to Gabon, since we're talking about Africa, and then return to Baghdad for 1988, because this leads into, again, what you were describing about Wilson's role in Angola. As Vanity Fair writes, in 1992, Wilson was rewarded with the ambassadorship to Gabon, where, he says, he helped persuade President Omar Bongo, quote, the most clever politician in African politics, end quote, according to Wilson, to have free and open elections. What really went on in Gabon, Ralph, during this period?
Well, you have to understand that what we're describing here is the replacement of Portuguese and French and Belgian imperial control over the resources of Africa by the United States and by U.S. imperialism itself. And it's a murderous process. It's a genocidal process. It's a process that involved millions of lives deliberately sacrificed through the process. As you say, he was rewarded with the ambassadorship to Gabon. Omar Bongo was a French creation in Gabon. And what was important to both French imperialism and American imperialism about Gabon is that it is rich in sweet and light oil. The Gabonese oil has a lower sulfur content and a higher gravity than that of Bonnylite and Forcados and Pennington Brass River.
Ralph is talking about the oils of Nigeria and Saudi Arabia.
Well, not Saudi Arabia. I'm giving the example of the prize crude oil of Nigeria. And here, with respect to Gabon, Wilson's role, they talk about free and open elections. What they're talking about was the CIA funding the elimination of French run functionaries in Gabon. From there he goes to Stuttgart and then to the National Security Council on whose behalf he, quote, revisits Niger. Now let's look at what occurs when he revisits Niger, the Forrest Gump of Valerie Plame's description. In April 1999, Mr. Wilson, on behalf of the National Security Council, visits Niger. Immediately there is a military coup and the assassination of President Ibrahim Badi Maynassara. These were the French functionaries installed in Niger. Now Wilson, quote, advises the new ruler of Niger, Major Daouda Malam Wanki, the leader of the coup, to help restore Niger to democratic rule. Democratic rule is the euphemism that the Central Intelligence Agency and American imperialism uses whenever they install their own people and replace those who are antithetical to imperial aims. The assassination of the president of Niger coincides with the arrival of Joseph Wilson, the Forrest Gump indeed. That is how Valerie Plame, as you say, he's always there when things happen. You're damn right he is. And indeed, as the Vanity Fair continues to describe, Wilson likes to be useful, and he briefs the CIA regularly on his involvement in Iraq, Africa, and Angola. He's reporting back. He's being debriefed on his assignment. Indeed, in early 2002, Valerie Plame asks her husband if he would come to discuss Niger and uranium, quote, a subject that Wilson had discussed with the CIA before, advises Vanity Fair. The first thing Wilson did in Niger was visit Ambassador Barbara Owens Kirkpatrick, and indeed to begin to discuss with her a report about Niger uranium. She said, yeah, I know a lot about this particular report. We thought we had debunked it. And oh, by the way, we're informed by Vanity Fair, a 4-star Marine Corps general had been down there as well, Carlton Fulford. And indeed, he is there, this 4-star Marine Corps general, to assess what to do with this report. This long precedes the setting up of the neocons in relation to this Niger document and the presentation of the yellow cake as the smoking gun to establish that Saddam Hussein is preparing a nuclear weapons program with the intention of attacking the United States. Just to finish the point, Maya, what we see here from the Vanity Fair profile on Wilson and Plain is that long antecedent to the neocons becoming interested in this fake report about Niger yellow cake, we have both Wilson and Plain involved in this activity. The U.S. ambassador, having already been made aware of the potential use of the yellow cake as a pretext for war by suggesting that it was in some connection to Saddam Hussein, and consulting Wilson about how to handle it, this antedates the neocon deployment of this information, and it begins to make clear that what we're looking at here is a night of the long knives in which the CIA is setting up the neocons for the fall to come.
And also what we have with Vanity Fair, Nation Magazine, The New York Times, elsewhere, where Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame are the heroes of the day. In fact, what we have with Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame are the gentlemen killers of the CIA, as characterized by Harrison Salisbury in his important article that appeared in Playboy Penthouse, many years ago. And at this moment, I'd like to remind you to listen again to Outing the Gentlemen Killers of the CIA, our two-part program of October 2003.
Maya, the Vanity Fair article begins as follows. At the Nation magazine award lunch, Wilson wept openly on the podium as he looked his wife straight in the eye and declared, "If I could give you back your anonymity." He swallowed, unable to speak for a few seconds. "You are the most wonderful person I know, and I'm sorry this has been brought on you." Valerie Plame teared up. The room was electrified. Moments later, Wilson recovered, and he concluded his remarks with the climax we had all been waiting for. "Let me introduce you to my wife, Valerie," he said. The occasion was the lunch, Vanity Fair continues, given by the Nation Magazine's Foundation and the Fertel Foundation to present the first Ron Ridenhour Award for Truth-Telling to her husband, Ambassador Joseph C. Wilson IV. This is the same Nation Magazine and Nation Institute that features Max Holland, who writes for the Central Intelligence Agency website, and it devotes his time to showing that those of us involved in exposing the role of the CIA in the Kennedy assassination, from Jim Garrison to myself when I sent the material pertaining to this to Jim in 1967, were in fact dupes and operatives of the KGB. The Nation Magazine's editorial board member, Max Holland, plays that role as he writes the same sort of disinformation on the CIA website itself. And now we find that the Nation Magazine and Nation Institute are funded by a particular component of the Ford Foundation, Central Intelligence Agency funding involved here. But we will come back to the relationship of the nominal liberal media and how they've been penetrated by the agency, and their role in orchestrating and reinventing and sheep-dipping who are Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame.
Well, Ralph, our choice now is to go into Wilson's career in Iraq or to move on to the actual hidden agenda.
Well, I think what we should do, Maya, I want to make one particular point about the Vanity Fair piece, because it is an extraordinary document. The Vanity Fair article, of course...
Well, Ralph, when you say extraordinary, they're presenting Wilson and Plame in a positive light. If people don't understand the history of what actually took place in Africa. They are presenting Wilson as if he's the great Democrat.
Well, what I want to emphasize about that when I say it's an extraordinary article is that anybody who has an understanding of these events and who can connect the dots, like, and that's what we do on Taking Aim, can see here the unfolding of the real role of these people and the elucidation of the entrapment. The entrapment of the neocons as the Central Intelligence Agency, and we'll discuss on whose behalf, sets them up for the fall that their own point man, Patrick Fitzgerald, is engaged in facilitating. Quote, one of the people who objected most fervently to the role of Cheney and his chief of staff, Louis Libby, was the CIA case officer, Alan Foley, head of the Weapons Intelligence Non-Proliferation and Arms and Control Center. Now, what is important about this? Alan Foley is not just the CIA case officer and the head of Weapons Intelligence and Non-Proliferation and Arms Control. He is the direct boss of Valerie Plame, and it is Alan Foley, on Plame's recommendation, that selects Mr. Wilson to go to Niger to investigate, nominally, something he's already known about long before, to investigate the authenticity of the Yellow Cake story and the Yellow Cake transfer to Iraq story that's been derived from Niger. So Wilson is sent there to examine the authenticity of what has become the centerpiece of the Cheney neocon Bush orchestration of their rationale for the war in Iraq. But he's sent there not by Cheney, he's sent there not by Bush, he's sent there by the Central Intelligence Agency and by the boss of his wife, Alan Foley. And then when he comes back, he doesn't report to Cheney, he doesn't report to Bush, he doesn't even inform them. He immediately is debriefed by the Central Intelligence Agency itself, and we'll deal with that in more amplitude in a moment.
Ralph, let's go now to an important article by Seymour Hersh that appeared. Excuse me?
No, it's okay, Maya. It's just that I thought we were going to deal with Wilson in Iraq, but
go right ahead.
Because I think it's important for us to understand not only the relationship of Wilson and Valerie Plame to the events in Niger, which we will continue to disclose, but what is also instructive is that, and we alluded to it in the first part of this show, is that the Mr. Wilson has a central relationship to the unfolding events in Iraq at the time of the first Gulf War. Because what we come to know is that Joseph Wilson was the point man in Baghdad. He was the point man in Baghdad for none other than George Bush Sr. In fact, as it's described in Vanity Fair in 1988, Wilson found himself in Baghdad as the number two to Ambassador April Glasby. She wanted someone who knew how to manage the embassy and who knew the issues deeply, Vanity Fair tells us. Then in late July 1990, the nominal ambassador takes her vacation to the United States, leaving, quote, Joseph Wilson in charge. The night of August 1st, Wilson had dinner with, quote, Saddam Hussein's principal arms buyer in Paris. He describes this dinner as follows. The guy looks like a Pancho Villa figure. We sat down to dinner, just him, myself, my wife, and the five bodyguards armed, unquote, describes Vanity Fair. What are we looking at here? Who is arming Saddam Hussein? Who is facilitating the arming of Saddam Hussein? Who is orchestrating the biological and chemical weapons that are being sent to Saddam Hussein? Who is directing all of this activity on behalf of George Bush Sr.? Oh, it's Joe Wilson, for whom? The National Security Council and the Central Intelligence Agency. Indeed, at the time that Iraqi troops are entering Kuwait, Wilson personally marches over to the foreign ministry, knocks on the door of Tariq Aziz, and they proceed to have an exchange. And it involves the restoration of direct dial phone capability to the American embassy in Baghdad. And Wilson says, "You've got your army now in Kuwait City, and my navy is in the Gulf. Let's avoid any escalation of the crisis if we can," says Joseph Wilson, setting up and putting to sleep Tariq Aziz as he had Saddam Hussein himself. This is no marginal figure in the workings of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is a point man in the entrapment of Saddam Hussein in Kuwait on behalf of George Bush. When April Glasby and James Baker and George Bush Sr. say to Saddam Hussein, "You've got a grievance in Kuwait, you should rectify your border," when they give him the green light to go there, who's the point man left in charge of all of that? Joseph Wilson, National Security Council, point man of Bush Sr. in Baghdad.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll return to our program after the station identification.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Hidden Agenda of the Libby Indictment, Part 2, The Night of the Long Knives. Seymour Hersh wrote in Vanity Fair in the issue October 27, 2003, an article called The Stovepipe. And stovepiping refers to sending intelligence up the ladder of the U.S. administration. And in it, he refers to the fact that in October 1997, this is many years before the assault on the current assault on Iraq, the International Atomic Energy Agency issued a definitive report declaring Iraq to be essentially free of nuclear weapons. The IAEA's inspector said, quote, "There are no indications that there remains in Iraq any physical capability for the production of amounts of weapon-usable nuclear material of any practical significance," end quote. The report noted that Iraq's nuclear facilities had been destroyed by American bombs during the 1991 Gulf War. Gary Dillon, a British nuclear safety engineer, spent 23 years working for the IAEA, and he retired as its chief of inspections. And he insists that it's highly unlikely that Iraq had been able to maintain a secret or hidden program to produce significant amounts of weapons-usable material. "This is not kitchen chemistry," Dillon said. "You're talking factory scale, and in any operation, there are leaks." So we have as early as 1997 the IAEA contending that Iraq was free of nuclear weapons. Now, this is very important because the myth, the fabrications for the assault on Iraq provided by the U.S. administration, this includes both the Bush administration and the Democratic Party who supported the assault on Iraq through the votes in Congress appropriating funds, that this excuse was weapons of mass destruction. Total fabrications orchestrated by Judith Miller in the New York Times, and Miller herself is a member of the American Enterprise
Institute,
the AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, the neocon think tank. So we have with the fabrications, one of which Joseph Wilson was involved in exposing, that is the sale of yellow cake, uranium derivative, to Iraq, emerging in 2003, shortly after President Bush, in his State of the Union message, referred to the British intelligence exposing the sale of yellow cake, and he and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice using illusions of a mushroom cloud and the importance of preventing a mushroom cloud emerging and the necessity to eliminate Saddam Hussein and to begin the assault on Iraq.
Well, let's look at this a little more carefully. You you mentioned Judith Miller in the New York Times. Judith Miller, who went to jail because she wouldn't disclose her source. Judith Miller, who is a vehicle for outing Wilson and for, excuse me, for outing Valerie Plame and demonizing Joseph Wilson. As you mentioned, Maya, Judith Miller, along with Lori Milroy, were American Enterprise Institute neocon operatives. They co-authored a book which attempted to establish that Saddam Hussein was the distributor and producer of biological and chemical weapons. They orchestrated the theme that Saddam Hussein was preparing weapons of mass destruction. They did this continuously in articles in the New York Times. The New York Times was one of the main instruments, interestingly enough, in promoting the disinformation about weapons of mass destruction in the hands of regimes that are being targeted for invasion and destruction. And it's also important to make note of the fact that this entire theme had been undertaken by the Clinton administration, and one of the people who was most instrumental in fomenting it was Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor of the people who are supposed to have outed Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame. And that's what we mean by the Night of Long Knives, because Patrick Fitzgerald was the person who was prosecuting the presumptive role of Osama bin Laden in the bombing of the embassies in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam, when in fact we have the ample documentation. We went into it in great detail. The World Socialist website has done a series that, as well, but we have documented extensively the fact that the bombing of the embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam was a Mossad and CIA operation. The San Francisco Chronicle has confirmed that the point man was, in fact, a longstanding CIA figure operating, even bringing al-Qaeda operatives who were CIA paid to the San Francisco Bay Area, and so on. And yet here we have the role assigned to Patrick Fitzgerald to invent the fiction that this was an Osama bin Laden terrorist operation. The same role was played by Patrick Fitzgerald in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center and indeed in the prosecution of Lynn Stewart, as we described last show. So the point to be made here is that the imputation of weapons of mass destruction is something that Clinton and Gore and the Democratic Party and the Central Intelligence Agency were deeply involved in fomenting. The very pretext, if you recall, brothers and sisters, for the bombing of the a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan under Clinton. The bombing of that was because they said weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical agents were being made there by Osama bin Laden in Sudan for use in Africa and in the Middle East. And indeed to be supplied to Iraq, and that fabrication was done under Clinton's watch. This brings it full circle.
Ralph, I suggest that our listeners go to tomdispatch.com and read an article by Jim Loeb, that's L-O-B-E, dating Cheney's nuclear drumbeat, framing the Plame case, where he has the details of the false stories planted by Judith Miller in the New York Times, such as about the aluminum tubes, the underground labs, and the Niger yellow cake, as well as the biological weapons of mass destruction. Because now I think it's important to go further into the Night of the Long Knives, that is the role of former CIA officers and the current CIA in setting up the neocons. Buried within the Seymour Hersh article that I referred to before, The Stovepipe, from October of 2003, He says, one theory, and this is about the fake Niger papers, one theory favored by journalists in Rome, and he's referring particularly to La Repubblica, which did an incredible three-part series, which two of the parts are translated into English and available on the Internet, is that SISMI, that is the Italian equivalent of the CIA, produced the false documents and passed them on to Panorama, which is a journal owned by Berlusconi, the prime minister, the president or prime minister, president of Italy, for publication. Another explanation, and this is the one that we're going to examine in further detail, and actually Seymour Hersh doesn't have it quite right, because there's been new information that shows that even the idea that SISMI produced the documents is incorporating former CIA officers. And this is his other explanation. It was provided by former CIA officers. Officer. He had been begun talking to me about the Niger papers in March. That's March of 2003, when I first wrote about the forgery. Quote, somebody deliberately let something false get in there. End quote. He became more forthcoming in subsequent months, eventually saying that a small group of disgruntled retired CIA clandestine operators had banded together in the late summer of last year, meaning 2002, and drafted the fraudulent documents themselves. The agency guys were so pissed at Cheney, the former officer said. They said, okay, we're going to put the bite on these guys. My source said that he was first told of the fabrication late last year, meaning 2002, at one of the many holiday gatherings in the Washington area of past and present CIA officials. Everyone was bragging about it. Here's what we did. It was cool, cool, cool. Ralph?
Well, Maya, yes, let's try to elucidate what we're describing here. Let's make this clear, I hope, for our listeners to grasp the nature of the Long Knives conflict. Joseph Wilson and Verrilli, Plame are key figures in the Central Intelligence Agency. Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame have a long history of targeting populations that resist U.S. imperialism, and indeed, Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame, no less than the Democratic Party itself, are instrumental in fomenting the fiction of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of those they choose to target. But what distinguishes these parties is the following. When the long-prepared direct seizure of Arab oil, for which every administration for nearly 40 years had contingency plans, was put into effect, it required ensnaring Saddam Hussein in Kuwait, which was accomplished after the Central Intelligence Agency and National Security Advisor Brzezinski had sent Iraq to attack Iran at the time of the Iranian Revolution. But what was the agenda of the Central Intelligence Agency and this wing of capital at the time of the ensnaring of Saddam Hussein? They did not intend to occupy Iraq. They deliberately withheld from sending U.S. troops onward into the occupation of Iraq. Their agenda was to starve out the Iraqi population with a UN-orchestrated blockade, and then, having done that, to effect a coup d'etat in Baghdad to have Sunni officers displace Saddam, more compliant and more subservient to their control of Iraq. But the wing linked to the Likud and to Sharon and to the Zionists, the neocons with Jinsa, that have given us, with other elements of the CIA, 9/11 itself had a different agenda. They want to own Iraq and Syria and to directly involve the U.S. armies in occupying these countries. And to do that, they had to bypass the Central Intelligence Agency and set up their direct SA-like apparatus of control. And that is the nature of the internecine conflict that we are witnessing here. And here we have, if you like, a very illuminating, I would even call it again a smoking gun, in Seymour Hersh's description, The Stovepipe, published in The New Yorker. Quote, who produced the fake Niger papers? There is nothing approaching a consensus on this within the intelligence community. Indeed, an explanation provided by senior CIA officers talking to me about the Niger papers in March, when I first wrote about the forgery, said, Someone deliberately let something false get in here. He became more forthcoming in subsequent months. Quote, a small group of retired CIA clandestine operators banded together in the late summer of last year and drafted these fraudulent documents themselves. These agency guys were so pissed at Cheney, they said, okay, we'll put the bite on these guys. My source said that he was first told of the fabrication late last year at one of the many holiday gatherings in the Washington area of present CIA officials. Everyone was bragging about it. Here's what we did. As you say, Maya, it was cool, cool, cool. With this crowd, referring to the neocons, it's the only way to go. We'll nail these guys. They don't practice good tradecraft and vetting intelligence, my source said. Indeed, the thinking was that these documents will be quickly endorsed by the hawks at the top of the Bush administration. They'll be unable to resist flaunting them. Then they will look stupid and foolish when intelligence officials point out that these are obviously fake. These are obviously fake. Quote, unquote. So, the retired clandestine officer tells Seymour Hersh that indeed CIA officers faked these documents and entrapped the neocons, the Cheney crowd, the operatives answerable to Michael Ledeen and James Woolsey and the neocons. And as Seymour Hersh observes, it is an extraordinary commentary on the levels of mistrust, bitterness, and demoralization within the Central Intelligence Agency under the Bush administration. So what we are hearing here and what we are establishing is what we've been asserting from day one, that the fight is between the Central Intelligence Agency answerable to a sector of capital for whom the neocon adventure into Iraq with direct occupation has now become reckless endangerment, notably because of the resistance of the Iraqi people and the disaffection of the American people, and now they are trying to lay this on the neocons and to nail them to a cross.
Ralph, Silvio Berlusconi, to correct myself, is the Italian prime minister. And an important article, Forging the Case for War, by Philip Giraldi, appeared in the American Conservative. It's November 21st, 2005 issue. Philip Giraldi is not a reporter. In fact, he is a former CIA officer and a member of Canestraro Associates, referring to Vincent Canestraro, the former head of covert operations for the Central Intelligence Agency. And he writes that he lays the blame on Michael Ledeen for disseminating the Niger documents, saying that people within the CIA had exposed these as clear forgeries, as well as the IAEA had looked at the documents after President Bush spoke his words for the State of the Union and pronounced them crude forgeries. I'd like to mention at this moment that the person who was signing the key document forgery. They used the name of a key Niger ambassador who had retired 11 years before. So these were crude forgeries for anyone in the know. But what Giraldi writes is he could have been assisted, meaning the fabricator, by ex-CIA friends from Iran-Contra days. In other words, Ledeen could have been assisted by ex-CIA friends from Iran-Contra days, including a former chief of station from Rome, who, like Ledeen, was a consultant for the Pentagon and the Iraqi National Congress. Now, the former station chief from Rome, unnamed, that he appears in many of the articles discussing the forged documents. And the forged documents, the yellow cake documents, had been presented again to the Bush administration by Niccolo Pollari, who was the chief of the SISMI, the Italian Intelligence Agency, Military Intelligence Agency, and the Italian Prime Minister himself when they made an official visit to Washington October 15th, 2001, shortly after 9/11. But it was Michael Ledeen from the Office of Special Plans who was in Rome, and he was paid $30,000 by the Italian Ministry of Interior in 1978 for a report on terrorism and was well known to the SISMI officials. Italian sources, according to Giraldi, his Italian sources, indicate that Pollari was eager to engage with the Pentagon hardliners, knowing that they were at odds with the CIA and the State Department officials who had slighted Pollari, who he had thought had slighted him when he had first presented the Niger Yellow Cake documents. He turned to Ledeen, who quickly established himself as the liaison between SISMI and Douglas Feith's Office of Special Plans, where he had been a consultant. Ledeen had personal access to the National Security Council's Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley, who was also a confidant of Vice President Dick Cheney. And so they were able to circumvent the CIA and the State Department, in other words, circumvent Secretary of State Colin Powell. Ralph.
Maya, to elucidate what we're describing here, the Night of the Long Knives, here is an article of some importance by Jeffrey Goldberg in The New Yorker called Breaking Ranks, What Turned Brent Scowcroft Against the Bush Administration. This is an article of the 31st of October of this year. Scowcroft, a retired Air Force general, was notably hawkish on the Iraq question, and this is during the time of the first Gulf War, more so than Secretary of State James Baker III, and more so than Dick Cheney, who was Bush Sr. Secretary of Defense. Scowcroft is a protege of Henry Kissinger. He was his deputy when Kissinger was Richard Nixon's national security advisor. And like Kissinger, he was a purveyor of the realist approach to foreign policy, etc. Now, here's what's interesting about this. Scowcroft argued unyieldingly for intervention at the time of the first Gulf War. And indeed, he became indispensable to George Bush Sr., subjecting war planners to sharp questioning over the question of the entrapment of Saddam Hussein in Gulf War I. The war began on January 16, 1991. And indeed, an air campaign that lasted 5 weeks, which utterly devastated Baghdad with implosion weapons that sucked all the oxygen out of the air, that set Baghdad back to the 14th century. It was an unleashing of tonnage that had exceeded those used in the entirety of World War II in all arenas, to give an idea of the enormous genocidal bombing that was unleashed by these people. Now, what's interesting again about this is that the CIA and Scowcroft and Bush Sr. and James Baker made the following assessment with respect to occupying Iraq at the time of the first Gulf War. James Baker told me he and Scowcroft got along well because Scowcroft and Baker spoke for the administration and coordinated their views. And they said, if we are not going to go in and take out Saddam Hussein, because then we will own Iraq and we won't be able to let go. And they said, look at the cost that will entail. It is much better for us to blockade the country and to effect a coup and a putsch. Scowcroft was consulted more frequently by the Clinton White House than he had been by George W. Bush. And in fact, Clinton's national security advisor, Samuel Berger, said that Clinton and his national security team highly valued Scowcroft's opinions. He knows a great deal. Arnold Kanter, Undersecretary of State in the first Bush administration, a principal in the Scowcroft Group, which is a private security firm, stated that it was, in fact, Scowcroft who was a key figure in shaping the policies of the Clinton administration and was the point man for George Bush Sr. Consequently, when the neocons made their determination with Cheney and Rumsfeld in tow to find a pretext for invading Iraq and for occupying a whole series of countries in the Arab East and for facilitating a World War IV agenda of the neocons, Scowcroft and Robert Gates, who was Scowcroft's deputy at the National Security Council, stated, "This is a calamity." Scowcroft was appointed chairman of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board in his first team, and indeed it is Scowcroft who breaks with the Bush administration publicly over the invasion of Iraq, and he does so on behalf of George Bush Sr. and that sector of capital that considers the neocons to be recklessly endangering the interests of American imperialism in the Arab East.
And Ralph, we discussed that in one of our prior Taking Aim shows, reckless endangerment, and particularly the opinion piece by Scowcroft that was published in the Wall Street Journal. We also have Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, October 25, 2005, an article, opinion piece again, the White House cabal that appeared in the L.A. Times, and it was a follow-up to his speech at the New American Foundation in Washington that shocked the Washington community. And he wrote, "In President Bush's first term, some of the most important decisions about U.S. national security, including vital decisions about post-war Iraq, were made by a secretive, little-known cabal. It was made up of a very small group of people led by Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Its insula and secret workings were efficient and swift, not unlike the decision-making one would associate more with a dictatorship than a democracy." And he goes on. We should note, however, that in the drumming up of an attack on Syria, it has unilateral support from both the Democratic and Republican parties. But what we have here is a sector of capital that is saying enough of this World War IV policy.
In the article about Scowcroft, there's a confrontation between Scowcroft and Condoleezza Rice after Scowcroft publicly denounces the invasion of Iraq. "How could you do this to us," said Rice. And Scowcroft says to Rice, "You know perfectly well this is not the policy that National Security and the Central Intelligence Agency laid out." And there's another confrontation between Rice and Scowcroft that is instructive. Rice indicates the importance of their achievement in getting Sharon to withdraw from Gaza, and Scowcroft counters by saying, "You think that's good news? That's bad news. They can't use half their army to maintain 8,000 settlers in Gaza. They're getting out of Gaza, but that's not the first act, that's the last. That's the end of any Palestinian state under our control." There you have a definition of the Sharon conflict, the neocon conflict with the mainstream of U.S. capital and the Central Intelligence Agency. The Night of the Long Knives is about the internecine conflict between two wings of the butchers of the peoples of the Arab East and the oppressors of the American people themselves. We will elucidate the meaning of this in further shows. Stay tuned, brothers and sisters. It is the Night of the Long Knives, the conflict between capital. We are the victims of both.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Please visit our archive, www.takingaim.info, and also the WBAI archive at www.wbai.org. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.